You're probably just waiting with bated breath to get your papers back. They're coming eventually. And so look in your mailboxes every now and then. Maybe next few weeks you'll find them there. And then the other thing is that I'm sure you would like a test sometime. The weeks are going by very quickly, so we won't have much time for tests. We may have one at the end, except for Debbie, who will get her midterm. But it's with the idea that I will give you some more assignments. Have you got enough work to do at the moment?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll talk to you later, John. See you. Mr. Hilda. And before this class disappears, let's have a word of prayer and begin. Well, we won't go over everything again, except to paraphrase what we've done so far, to say that we have present persecution and future fulfillment. Present persecution, Peter says, you're going to get it one way or the other. It's going to come. But your faith will be proved and the realistic truth of your faith will be evidenced. Just like gold under fire, then the pure gold will be revealed. So we thank God for persecution. We thank God for pressure, that we can operate under pressure. And the fact that our inheritance, that salvation, which will be capstoned by the return of Christ, we have a hope which is unashamed because he's going to come back. And then we also think in terms of the truths that were revealed by Peter saying, hey, this message of salvation was looked at by the prophets. It was proclaimed by apostles and teachers now. You're enjoying it. You've got something yet to come. And angels look into it with amazement and want to know more about it. And that's basically where we left last week. Then we said, if we have a salvation which is to come, we have a tremendous hope in the future. And yet, in the present, we know there's a tremendous responsibility also to be of holy character. And that's what we've got in our outline right now. And unfortunately, we can talk about holiness, we write about holiness, we preach holiness, but what's the last thing we do? Be holy. We fail to respond to the teaching, to the reading, to the preaching, whatever it might be. In your outline, A Life of Holiness, chapter 1, verse 13 to 21, we'll see two things. Instruction given, you've got that, haven't you? And provision made. We are given then some instructions now about holiness. We are given some instructions as to be holy. And then there is a provision made for that holiness. And I want us to just add to our outline there. First thing, look to the revelation of Christ. That's not quite on the picture there, but look to the revelation of Christ. Notice what it says in verse 13. Wherefore, girding up the loins of your mind, be sober, set your hope perfectly on the grace that is to be brought unto you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. At the moment, what does Peter instruct these believers to do? When we put down, look to the revelation of Christ, what do I really mean? Look to the revelation of Christ. Yes. That is true. That's absolutely true. In the context, however, what is he saying here? For instance, in verse 13, look to the revelation of Christ. Right, when he comes back, there's grace going to be revealed at Christ's return. So the first instruction he gives to them, and the basis of the present persecution, future fulfillment, is say you can look towards heaven and know that Christ is coming back. Instructions then are to expect, to look for the return of Christ. He's coming. And that establishes the hope. Establishes really three things in this verse. First of all, he says, set your mind. Set your mind. And we talked about the other day, these folks in these days wore these long robes. And if you wanted to get somewhere in a hurry, what did you do? You gathered in, tucked it in. What phrase do we use if you want to tell somebody to get on with the job that would match what he's saying? Tuck your skirts into your belt or your robes into your belt, what would we say? Huh? Get your act together, but pull up your sleeves, roll up your sleeves, or pull up your socks. Right. If you've got socks to pull up. It means get on with the job. You don't use pull up your socks. All right. All right. Thanks, Garth. Thank you, Garth, for that interpretation. Roll up your sleeves, get on with the job. He's saying this then, wherefore, girding up the loins of your mind. That's pictorially saying here that you are to pull up your mental capacities. It's to brush aside the cobwebs and exercise the power of understanding that God has given you. He's given us an understanding. Therefore, exercise the power of that understanding. Don't let your everything flow and you get in the way. Have a clear mind. In other words, set your mind on one thing. And that's the revelation of Christ and his grace which is to come. And we say that from Colossians, set your mind on things that are above, not on things upon the earth. What happens when you're so involved with things upon the earth? You don't look for the return of Christ. You don't expect him to come. You're so wrapped up in those things around you that you haven't girded up your belt, tucked in the and on down the road. Second thing we see is to sober your thoughts. And actually the word sober there, and it does use the word sober, be sober and set your hope. Be sober does come from the word that speaks of abstinence from strong drink, from wine, from alcohol. In other words, he says, don't be incapacitated here by something that would control you. And he's referring to alcohol initially, but the picture is this, that your thoughts, metaphorically speaking, are to be alert. You are to be morally alert and have a life that is disciplined and under self-control. Somebody who's drunk is not in control. He's out of control. And so the picture is that if you are abstaining from that which would control you, such as drink, in the illustration here, you are under discipline, you are self-control. So sober your thoughts, have your mind alert, and have your life disciplined. Yes? I say the word should be I did. Right? Did. All right. Yeah, doesn't seem to happen. Doesn't seem to happen to me that way. Yeah. That's the picture, yeah. Well, somebody who is drunk, very little affects him. He can ramble. There are two sides, we know. You either get angry or get happy. And anything can happen on the outside. It really doesn't affect you. There's no alertness, is there? We know, just looking at the last night, we have a real problem in this country, alcohol-wise. The number of high school kids, and this is a problem. It's worse than drugs right now. The number of kids who are being killed, accident-related, is thousands because of alcohol. And you think in terms of that there's no alertness, whether it's driving or what. There's no alertness to what's going on around you. And so he says, hey, have a mind that's sober, that can think straight. And there's discipline then available. Now, it's easy to say that, to have get everything together in your mind and to be sober. But he's going to explain there is a provision to how that can be made, how that does happen. The third thing ties up in full circle what we said. Look to the revelation of God. Set your mind. Let's get things together. Don't let your clothing be hanging all over the place, but be prepared. A mental awakening. You're exercising the understanding God has given you. And be morally alert. Be under control. Disciplined in your mind. And third thing, set your hope. It says in verse 13, set your hope perfectly on the grace. And setting your hope is that the believer surely has a tremendous privilege and can expect. It should be the characteristic of the believer that he expects Christ to come and fulfill all that Peter has been indicating by his inheritance. All right, so we've got those three things. We're looking to the return of Christ, and with that in mind, we've set our minds, we've sobered our thoughts, and we have a hope which is undeterred. It's an expectant one. We as believers have that privilege. The next part, into the provision made, right? You've got that? And maybe we can... I know it rolls. I think we'll just get rid of this, though. If the first thing was the instruction given, there's a provision made. And under the provision made, we have a relationship to the Father. So, first was instruction given. Two, provision, right? Maybe we have... No, I'm sorry. I'm taking it too far. We have another thing yet. I've left something out here. It's this. I gave you a look to the revelation of Christ. Next thing is live as children. Of obedience. Can you read my writing there? Live with children of obedience, and there are two things. Refrain from... What is it? Refrain from lust, right? Evil desires. And secondly, respond in holiness. So instructions that Peter's giving: look to the revelation of Christ, expect him to come, and that should have effect upon the way I'm thinking. It should have an effect upon how my hope is, my thoughts, all that gathered together in verse 13. The second instruction he gives is that we should live as children of obedience. In other words, our mother, as it were, is obedience. Our mother is obedience. And the first thing we see there is refrain from lust. The twofold, if you like, purpose of God in this passage, as you read through it, is perhaps put in these two things. If there's a twofold purpose, it has to be two things. First of all, it's to do his will, isn't it? It's doing his will. And we see there the word obedience. I think that ties up for us the opportunity then to do his will. His will is to practice obedience, isn't it? That's what God has in mind, that we practice obedience. What is the other purpose of God as far as Peter's concerned here? We're to live as children of obedience. We refrain from lust. In other words, our practice is to do his will. What else does he have in mind as we are children of obedience, doing his will, practicing obedience? What else do we find in these verses here that would be the purpose of God? Holiness, which is to be like him. So to do his will and to be like him. That's the purpose of God for the believer. Obedience and likeness. We can even go back to the book of Genesis and see that God, when he created Adam, he, having established him in the garden, put in the middle of the garden a tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. What was the relationship? One of obedience. God said, don't, and Adam should not have done. Obedience. But also we see that he is perfect. He has maintained through obedience what? Holiness. And this is what we see today. We maintain holiness through obedience. There's a direct link between the two. Obviously, faith is involved, and the possibility of the life of Christ's life, which is available to us. But as I am obedient to him, and this is pictured all through the Old Testament, and we're going to see that in a moment from Israel, the relationship that Israel had by obedience to God, by a demand of his law, meant that they could have fellowship with God. And anybody who has fellowship with God, is in communion with God, is holy. So the two are directly linked. prior to conversion, what do we know people are ignorant of? Prior to becoming a Christian, what are two things that we're ignorant of in the light of what we've said? God's purpose for us is that we practice obedience to Him. We are submitted to Him, and that we be like Him, because He created us to be like Him. So we know that. What is it that we are ignorant of before we become Christians in the light of those two things? What are we ignorant of? Are we not ignorant of who God is? Therefore, we're ignorant of what He's like, character, right? What else are we ignorant of before we become His will? We don't know what God's will is until we come to know who He is. You see how that's tied together? Old Testament again, God took for Himself a people. When they got to know Him, then they began to find out what His purposes are, His will was. Aren't you finding that as you spend the time here and get to know Him, what are you beginning to find out? What God's will is, yes, specifically for you, but overall you're beginning to find out what God's purpose is, right? And isn't that what we're here for? To know God's will. Some of you said that, remember, the first time I came here to find God's will. And in your mind, I think you meant God's will for your life. What you're finding, though, not only are you discovering some truths about God's will for your life, what are you finding out? You're finding out the greatness of God's purposes and God's will on this earth, and that you're directly involved with them, right? So the person who's not a believer doesn't know who God is, and therefore doesn't know His character, that He's holy and loving and perfect. But then, if he doesn't know that, he can't know His will either. So when we become a Christian, Peter's saying, hey, you're now finding out who He is, and you see that He's holy, and therefore God is calling us to be like Him. And at the same time, He wants us to be obedient. There's an obedience in relationship there. All right, the first thing we see is to refrain from lust. And that's in verse 14. As children of obedience, not fashioning yourself according to your former lusts in the time of your ignorance. The ignorance there is ignorance of God's character, ignorance of God's will. So Peter's saying to them, live no longer, and these are the instructions, don't live any longer in those ways which you lived before. Refrain from lust. And the word to fashion means to have see something changeable. What do we talk about when we talk about fashion today? Clothing. And does it change? All the time. So he says, don't be changeable. Don't fashion yourselves how? What's the word here? Don't fashion yourselves according to your former lusts. We lived our lives, and can't say we only did live, we do live our lives, indulging in our appetites. We indulge ourselves to be self-satisfied. We want to satisfy ourselves, right? And particularly before we became a Christian, not that it's all over now, we find, anybody still have the same problem? You say, well, it's not a problem. Isn't that the way I'm supposed to be? Yes, but under God's direction, to fulfill what He had in mind. Our trouble is that we had an old way of life. We indulged ourselves, the natural appetites that run harmful when in excess. God has built in us, yes, natural desires, and they're to be fulfilled in right perspective to God's will, not in excess. And he's saying here, lust is an excess. And therefore, let me instruct you, says Peter, that you don't live in your former way of life, in ignorance, when you didn't know God and you didn't know His will, but that you live as children of obedience. Let obedience be your mother. Let it be the one that is the determining factor of the way of life that you live. There was no standard, he said, before you became a Christian. There was no knowledge, no true knowledge. In fact, we can say that the standard of the unbeliever is based upon what? We're generalizing now a little bit. The standard of the unbeliever tends to be, it fluctuates with culture.
There is no standard.
Well, there is a standard, actually, yeah.
Yeah, but the standard is not
there's no absolute. No. Right, there's no absolute standard. The standard is based upon how I view mankind. My standard might be dependent upon how my parents brought me up. Might be determined by the high school I went to. It'll be determined by my peer group. It'll be determined by my university, right? But what's Peter getting at? He's saying when you have seen God's character, you'll find an absolute standard. When you've seen him to be a certain characteristic, when you see him in a certain way, and when he demands that of you, you say, that is some standard. That's higher than I can ever attain. It's true, because it's only found through the redemptive one in verse 18 and 19. So Peter says, your instruction is to refrain from lust. The satisfaction of your own standard, to the satisfaction of your own desires, refrain from that. Because actually, in one sense, Garth's right, there is no standard. You have no standard. You're based upon what is fluctuating by the time you live, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the prevailing fashion of the world, whether it is clothes or not, doesn't make any difference. Just whatever the prevailing fashion is at the moment. He's saying, don't allow that to be the one that controls you. Now, a person today would say, well, I'm free. I can do what I like. I'm free. But you're not. You're bound to what? The fluctuations of society. And there's no absolute. The person who's free is the person who no longer has to be controlled by certain hair lengths, certain dress lengths, certain sexual demands. He's not controlled by. He's free to do what? The will of God. That's true freedom. That's true freedom, is to do the will of God. Right, refraining from lust then, he describes that in verse 14. As children of obedience, we won't fashion ourselves according to former lusts in the time of your ignorance. That's when you didn't know God and you didn't know his will. Verse 15, but like as he who called you is holy, be ye yourselves also holy in all manner of living. That's respond to in holiness. You refrain from lust, there's a standard. And so you respond how? In holiness. When you have seen the standard, and as Christians we know the standard today, what is should be the desire of our heart? To be like him. To be like him. And that's why we have to respond in holiness. There is a new standard. In what area is it supposed to be? Just the way I dress? What's the verse tell us? In all manner of living, in all you do, verse 15. Be ye yourselves also holy in all manner of living. How holy? Do you have a little hard time being as holy as he is? But is that what God wants? Is Peter saying you are to be holy as he is holy? Is he saying it or is he not? He's saying it, isn't he? Does that mean I can sort of say, well, Lord, I can't, so I'm not going to even try? Or, Lord, that's impossible. That's not a standard that is suitable for mankind. You know how he is. You know how we are. So let's just let it go. Oh God, you can forgive me when I do things wrong. Is this an absolute standard or not? Mm-hmm. It's an absolute standard. And he has given it to us. It's a new standard. We go back to the books of the Old Testament. We see Israel redeemed from bondage out of Egypt. And they're brought to God. He has brought them to himself. And then what does he do? What did he do with the children of Israel after they had left Egypt? Think back through your Old Testament. What did he do? Took them through the Red Sea, and then what? Where was the first place he got them to? Mount Sinai. Why was it that he took them to Mount Sinai? Why did he give them law? To give them a standard. Did they have a standard in Egypt? There's a standard set by Egyptians. You'll be slaves. You'll be in bondage. What did God do first? He took them out of Egypt and he showed to them who? Himself. Let me take you to the verses that make this clear. Exodus and chapter 3. And verse 13. This is just before the children of Israel are taken out of Egypt. Moses has seen the burning bush and for himself has seen the holiness of God. For God said to Moses, take your shoes off, the ground on which you stand is holy. And he saw the burning bush and he knew that God spoke to him out of the bush. And God said to Moses, I want you to go to Egypt to deliver the children of Israel for me. I have heard their groanings and I know of their bondage and I want to deliver them for myself. Moses said, verse 13, unto God, behold, when I come unto the children of Israel and shall say unto them, the God of your father hath sent me unto you, and they shall say to me, what is his name? What shall I say unto them? And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am hath sent me unto you. I am hath sent me unto you. If you have to, Moses, and I know you must, go to the children of Israel and they ask you, who sent you? You tell them that I am has sent you. Now, what is the Hebrew word for I am? Yahweh, or what we would call now Jehovah. Jehovah. Did they know Jehovah? Not in that way. They've never heard Jehovah. They know Elohim. I am has sent you. So Moses goes back, as we know, and he has the I am with him in presence, and he begins to tell them, I am has sent me. Who? Jehovah. It's then that they begin to find out who Jehovah is. And after revealing himself by the plagues, they begin to find out who he is by what he does. Correct? After the children of Israel are delivered from Egypt, they go through the Red Sea, they come to the other side, and we find that this is what they say. Get the verse for us. Chapter 14. And verse 30. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead upon the seashore. And Israel saw the great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians. That's a tough one, isn't it? Israel saw the great work which the Lord did upon the Egyptians, and the people feared the Lord. And they, what's the next phrase? They put their trust, or they believed in Jehovah. They believed in him. Why? Because they had come to know him. Right? By name, Jehovah. When then the Lord took them, for the next 3 months, they went down to which place? The name of the place is Sinai. They've seen what God's done, and they say, we believe. We believe in the God of Moses. He is now our God. We know him. We know him. But then God took them down where? To Sinai. And what did he do at Sinai? He gave them the law. Remember on the mountain, the thunder, the lightning came, and God had instructed Moses and said, don't let the people touch the mountain. Why? Because they will die. Why would they die? Because God is a holy God, and they are a sinful people. All the children of Israel see the mountainside. It must have been some sight to see the thunder, the lightning. Something maybe you're picturing last night, if you saw the lightning at all. And then it tells us in verse 20, after the Ten Commandments have been given, we better read verse 18 of chapter 20. All the people perceived the thunderings and the lightnings and the voice of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood afar off. And they said unto Moses, speak thou with us, and we will hear. But let not God speak with us, lest we die. And Moses said unto the people, fear not, for God is come to prove you, and that his fear may be before you, that you won't sin. What was the first thing God wanted to do for the children of Israel when he sent Moses to them? I hope you're following me. No. The first time he sent Moses to the children of Israel, what was it necessary for Moses to do? Even before delivering them. Even before showing the power of God. Although he did that. That they might know him as Jehovah the I Am. To know him. And when they began to know him, as Charlie said, evidenced by signs, the miracles in Egypt, the plagues, even the deliverance from Pharaoh and the death of those Egyptians, the people said, we believe in Jehovah. He is the one who's caused this great deliverance for us. Right? We today know what it is to be delivered from what? Bondage. We know if we have Christ in our hearts and our lives, that we know we're not going where? To a lost eternity, to hell. But is that all that God wants? No. For just as he did with the children of Israel, take them to Mount Sinai and reveal to them what? His holiness, his character. And he said, I am going to show you and I'm going to prove you that you might not sin. What does God have in mind for us as Christians, those who he has redeemed from sin and its bondage? What does God have in mind for us? That we do not sin. So that's why Peter says, be ye holy as he is holy. Do you get the parallel, the picture there? Because it's tremendous. Peter's going to draw us always to the Old Testament and use the illustration of the Old Testament consistently throughout his writing here, the first epistle, and many, should I say, consistently in many places. So to know God is very important, and then obviously to see his character. Likeness. God redeemed us, and now it is that he calls us to be holy. Right? And I can give you just those verses, Exodus 6, verse 6 and 7, 19, 3 through 6, and the one we looked at was Exodus 19, verse 20. Let me show you verse 32 of chapter 23. Right? If you turn to Exodus 23 and Exodus 24. Because I think here we see the voice of a people just as much as what we would say this morning at his hill. God tells them in chapter 23 and verse 32, thou shalt make no covenant with them nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee, what? Sin against me. For if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee. This perhaps is pictured by the lust that Peter speaks of. Don't have in your company gods that are contrary to me. There's no such thing as these idols. There's no such thing as another god. They are idols. Don't long for them. Have them out of the way. And Peter's saying, refrain from lusts. Then notice what 24 says, verse 1. He said unto Moses, come up unto Jehovah, thou and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship ye afar off, and Moses alone shall come near unto the Lord. But they shall not come near, neither shall the people go with him. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the ordinances, and all the people answered with one voice and said what? All the words which the Lord hath spoken will we do. Peter is saying the same thing to us as Christians. He says, you know the Lord, you've been redeemed. Therefore, the result of knowing God by Christ is that you will do what he says, obedience. And you'll be what he wants. And that's what? Holy. What would we this morning say to God when we respond to Peter's question or Peter's command? Be holy. What do we say? All right? We can't, but Christ can. We realize that. That's true. And that's the only way. But what will we say if we're going to use the words of the children of Israel? We'll do it. We want to. I think if I would understand every person in here, you want to be what God wants, right? Is that right? About 10 of you. It's really encouraging. No, I know all of you do. You want to be what God wants. And Peter's saying here, I know you folks do. You have now a standard. These are the instructions. That you refrain from lust and that you respond in holiness. And he's used the illustration in the Old Testament, the children of Israel being brought out of bondage to God for himself. And then he's saying to these children, hey, let me show you what I'm really like. And he gives them the mountain experience of the thunder and lightning. He gives them the law and he says, that's what I'm like. It's like, let me take this illustration, Kyle and myself, or Kyle and Heather. As their fathers, they begin to grow up, they're getting to know me. They can get to know me and they love me. But what am I also going to ask of them? That they love and obey me. I'm giving them instructions. But what if I didn't give them any instructions? What if I didn't care how they lived? What kind of father is that? Pretty rank, huh? What if I said, hey, listen, kids. We sat down at the breakfast table this morning and said, I'm your dad. I love you. But I just want you to do what you want to do. You just go out and play today and you can do anything you like. In fact, if you go to the rock house, you'll find some 22s and some shotguns. And you just have a good old time around here. There's a canoe down the river, it's flooding, but go have a good old time on the river. And there's a bus you can drive to Kerrville. There's a Trans Am out there. I'm sure that Herb won't mind if you take that for a couple of hours. Excuse me. I'm sorry to say things like that. Thank you for correcting me. And we think in terms of all that I would say of the kids. I just don't bother with them. Is that good? No. You see, I am their standard. Right now, I'm their standard. As their children, as my children, I am their standard. And how I am is going to affect them day by day. What does that mean? I have to live the standard I speak about. Now, does God have any trouble living the standard he has already declared? No, not at all. But the amazing thing, and this is what Charlie brought out, is that God puts demands upon you and me to be equal to the standard that he's given. But he knows, and we know from all the Old Testament experience, that people cannot live up to that standard. So what has he given? He's given the provision in Christ. And that's what he comes to next. Having given the instructions, the second thing he says is there's a provision. There's a provision made. And the provision is, the time is going, the provision is. Firstly, I'll put down the provision this time. A relationship with the Father. Okay, the first provision is relationship to the Father. And secondly, we've got redemption through
It's trouble being left-handed.
Yes, sir. What provision has God made to meet the demands that Peter instructs us? Two things stand out. It's in these verses right here. First of all, he's given us a relationship to the Father. Notice verse 17. And if you call on him as Father, who without respect of persons judgeth according to each man's work, pass the time of your sojourning in fear. We'll find there is a reverential fear of God. It's not the fear that is the trembling fear of someone who's going to club you over the head or do all nasty things to you. No, that's not it. It's the reverential fear we have for a God who has revealed himself as being mighty, powerful, holy, all that, and yet loving. It's the awesomeness of God. And we look at that aspect of God and we can call him Father. We can cry, as Paul says, Abba, Father. That God, who is holy and righteous and awesome, who put all this world together, who knew and had under his control a little storm last night, we can say, Daddy. We can call him Father. And because of what we see in the redemption of Christ, we have access to him when? All the time. And that's a tremendous privilege, isn't it? First thing then, a relationship to the Father. The kind of God, our Father, who does not judge impartially. That's what it's saying here. He doesn't look at some of you and say, aha, now's my opportunity to get on you, your case. And they look at some of them and say, I'm going to treat you this way, I'll treat this person. He is absolutely fair in the way he judges people, isn't he? He will treat us just the same. There's no impartiality with God. That's the kind of father I like, isn't it? And the kind of father you like? He treats ones the same. The second thing, and we'll have to close this because time has gone, is the redemption through the Son. By the way, it talks of our sojourning here. Pick that up because that comes in later. Our alien registration. You know what I mean? We're just here for a little while. Then he says, while you're here, you can pass the time on earth in relationship to the Father, knowing that he's not impartial. I mean, he is impartial. He's not judging one person this way and the other person that way. He is totally respectful of that. And we'll stick with it. Then he says, knowing. We can know that you were redeemed, not with corruptible things, with silver or gold, from your vain manner of life, handed down from your fathers, but with precious blood as of a lamb, without blemish and without spot, even the blood of Christ. So not only do we have a reverential fear for our relationship to God, but we recognize that there's been a purchase made, a very special one, by redemption through the Son. It's a very special one, and we're going to have to look at it tomorrow. Because God had already, even before man sinned, made a way of escape. It was by the death of Christ. He already knew Christ was the one to come. Even before we turned from God. Even before man fell into sin. Well, those are quite powerful instructions that Peter gives, aren't they? We'll find that they are to affect us in all manner of life. We have a Father who loves us very much and who has given us instructions. And yet he's made a provision for us that in our relationship to him, because he's purchased us with his own blood, that is the blood of Christ, that we have now a relationship that can be in oneness with him, in a relationship of dependence to him, in a relationship of obedience to him. And we'll find that this is going to give more and more an outworking through the Epistle of Peter, into our daily lives. Okay, let's have a word of prayer together.